This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Jonathan Lethem has become one of America's most celebrated writers. But the author of the bestsellers Motherless Brooklyn and Fortress of Solitude once told us on Soundcheck that if he could write songs, he would never have written books. Well, with his new novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, Lethem comes perilously close to doing both. The book follows the near rise and all-too-complete fall of a fictional rock band in L.A. and has spawned an interesting side project, part of which you're hearing in the background. Jonathan, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So, knowing you as a music obsessive, I have to ask, which came first, the story, the book, or the song lyrics that are within it?
Oh, definitely the story. I mean, I let the characters kind of become a band, and then I wondered what sort of music they would think was funny to, you know, to try to play. And you know, they're very much the kind of art school band. They don't come out of music culture as such. Whether or not maybe one of them, you know, had parents that kept them at piano lessons or something. They definitely were probably all. You know, they have English degrees or you know.
Now, do you know this when you're writing about your characters? I mean, do you are you one of those authors who comes up with an entire kind of CV for every character in the book?
Not one that's sort of written out. I don't have a dossier, but I feel my way into their sensibilities, and of course they're all projections of the kind of people I know and myself, and most of the people I've known who were in rock bands were not, whether or not they at some level had their eye on the main chance, they weren't coming at it in a kind of professional way. And in fact, when I was in high school, which is my first taste of, you know, kind of aspiring rock and roll culture, I went to music and art high school in New York, and all the musicians were jazz or classical musicians, and all the art students were in rock bands.
as we saw when punk began, and you had bands like Talking Heads coming right into town. Now, you wrote two big, ambitious books, both set in Brooklyn, Motherless Brooklyn, Fortress of Solitude. This is set in L.A., and it's definitely a kind of breezier—I mean, it's a funny book. In a lot of ways, yeah. Were you intentionally trying to, you know, play against type? What was the idea behind setting it on the other coast?
Well, I mean, before those Brooklyn books, of course, I lived and wrote in California for a long time, and several of my earlier novels are set more or less in the Bay Area. Although when I use California as a setting instead of Brooklyn, I tend to make it a kind of cartoonish reality. It's a little more like the California of, you know, of Pynchon's Crying of Lot 49 or something. It's not too, you'd say I'm not being incisive about the gentrification of Silver Lake the way mm-hmm. I was in Borum Hill. But I'm very attracted to the sense of possibility and the opportunities for lunacy that I find in West Coast culture. There's a kind of utopian calamity to the way people live out there that, well, it attracted me for 10 years and I still think about it, and this is a kind of musing on that culture.
The book is called You Don't Love Me Yet by Jonathan Lethem. What's in a name? I mean, we have Falmouth Strand, an artist in the book, the radio DJ Fancher Autumnbreast and his assistant whose name is simply Morsel. The guitarist in the band is Bedwin Greenish. Bedwin? I mean,
Bedwin,
you
yeah.
might as well have called him the Venerable Bede or something.
Well, you know, the true source of my weird names is that when I was a reader, and every writer is a reader first, I could never keep the name straight in books I liked, unless the author, like Dickens, had given them something very flamboyant and bizarre, and then I'd hold on to it. If the characters were just sort of named, you know, Al and Bill and Fred and, you know, Miller, Smith and Thompson, I would never be able to keep them straight. So this is just a service I offer to readers.
Okay. Funny thing is that the band around which the story centers resists having a name at all.
Yeah. I think I like, to be a little more serious about it, if you think about Fortress of Solitude, all the characters in that book have multiple names. They're sort of their name and their nickname assigned to them by one of the characters, Mingus, who's a great nicknamer, and then there's their tag, which is another identity, and then if you go to prison, you get given a number, this idea that, you know, there, you can be sort of lost in a variety of possible identities was very much the theme of that book. And I think this one, which is a much dippier set of people, they're almost people who can't locate names at all. They're so unformed and sweetly hapless that their names keep slipping away from them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you create a whole scene. I mean, it's not just the band, which comes to be known as Monster Eyes after their fledgling hit song, but there's a whole culture. There are other bands who are constantly referred to and brought back as kind of exemplars of local groups made good.
The rain injuries.
The rain injuries.
Yeah, that's... I actually... It's very hard to make up a band name that doesn't exist. I kept making up band names and then going and corroborating them on MySpace, and there'd always be a band. In fact, there'd usually be 7 or 8 bands with more or less the name I just made up. So it was quite difficult, and I actually resorted to putting some names of bands that pretty much only I remember into the book. So they're not really fictional. I mentioned Memorial Garage, which was a very real precursor band to a Massachusetts band called the Winter Pills. And I mentioned Sold American, and I'm certainly not the only person who remembers Sold American, although they were sort of commemorated by the rock writer Camden Joy for being the forgotten band. And I enjoyed mixing these sort of real obscurities in with my own coinages.
Mm-hmm.
But the rain injuries are my guys.
Right. And the band Monster Eyes, I mean, who are some of the people that you had in your minds here? I mean, you've brought some CDs in, and a little bit later on we'll hear the kind of songwriting projects that have spun off this. But
yeah,
when you were writing the book and you were thinking of what the music on this scene sounds like, who were you listening to?
Well, you know, I was casting back to my own 20s. These characters are all sort of in that, you know, panic of their late 20s when they have to sort of get real or run screaming back to graduate school. And I was thinking of that time in my own life. So, of course, by association, I thought of a lot of the bands that were sort of momentary heroes to me then, and I was sure were going to sort of take the world by storm. And some of them are memorable or remembered commonly, and some aren't. But I think of Glass Eye and Christmas and Big Dipper. But I also, of course, with this band that has these, you know, there are 2 women and 2 men in the band, and there's a relationship in the band that's on and off again. So sometimes they're a band with a breakup in it. I was thinking of bands that are characterized by romantic entanglements. So the Mamas and the Papas, Fleetwood Mac, the Go-Betweens, you know, there's any number. I guess There's the White Stripes, which is nothing but an ex couple,
right?
And
Fleetwood Mac, 2 ex couples in one band. That was a good one.
And also, you know, Lucinda, the main character, is a female bass player, and I always think there's something very cool and mysterious about bands where the men sing and the women play instruments.
So you mentioned the Go-Betweens, and one of the tracks you brought us is Robert Forster, who basically half with Grant McLennan.
Right. Well, they're just real heroes of mine, and of course now it's a very a sad, nostalgic reverence I hold for them, because they finally can't be Go-Betweens anymore because Robert Forster died last year. But what was so beautiful about their story was that they were a great band that remembered they were a great band and got back together and had a second great phase recently with the three albums in the last, six or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
This song is technically a Robert Forster. Oh, excuse me, I'm saying that Robert Forster died. It's Grant McLennan.
Grant McLennan, right.
Pardon
right.
me. This song is technically a Robert Forster solo song that leads off one of his solo records right after the band first broke up. But it was co-written by Grant McLennan, and it sort of has a self-referential quality.
Jonathan Lethem is my guest. His book is called You Don't Love Me Yet. This is some music from Robert Forster.
You're home late, and you smell of the music that you make. All my patience, all my love, that's now all at stake. And it amounts to a lot, and it seems like I'm trying and you're not. So do something about me. Do something about me. Do something about me. Do it soon, my friend.
Robert Forster from the band The Go-Betweens, Rock and Roll Friend. We're speaking with Jonathan Lethem about his new novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, which follows the story, basically, of a band, two couples in L.A. trying to make it as a band. And there are numerous song titles that are referred to. There are lyrics in the book. There's also, Jonathan, on the cover, a picture of you with a guitar. Do you play?
No, I'm about as close to that guitar on the cover of that book as I ever got, which is to say several inches away.
In the same room.
What I like about that photograph is it's got a kind of fear of music quality to it. I want to be seen with an electric guitar, but I'm not sure I want to dare to touch it.
So did you actually try? I mean, as we'll discuss in our second segment, you know, all these song lyrics are out there for people, for musicians to actually set,
right?
Which is a big project. But did you try setting them?
Well, I just don't have the – I really lack the talent. I can't sing on key, and I can't write music. So I'm helpless except to collaborate with musicians, which is what I've done for my own kind of vicarious pleasure over the years intermittently.
All right. Now, the book, you know, has this band, which comes to be known as Monster Eyes. They're really struggling. As you said before, they're struggling with their own identity as a band, let alone getting a name, until Lucinda, their bass player, stumbles upon this source of great lyrics from this guy who calls the complaint line that has been set up as a kind of performance art thing. And she takes some of his complaints, writes them down, they become lyrics. The band suddenly gels in a way that it hasn't before. Are you suggesting that lyrics are what, you know, that it's the words that turns competent musicians into genuine songwriters?
Well, you know what, almost the opposite. I think lyrics are strangely irrelevant, and it's one reason I dare to write them and offer them to musicians, is that I think while musicians can sometimes be very intimidated by language and think, oh, you know, we need a writer for this, I think writers make usually the worst lyricists, and that a lot of the best songs come from a kind of almost garbage language, that there's a sort of tendency for phrases that float around to become deepened and turned into something meaningful by their appropriation by a musician. You know, if you think about Buddy Holly grabbing on to That'll Be the Day from The Searchers and turning it into that immortal song, or you know, there were certain soul singers in the 60s and 70s who almost made a policy of taking the stupidest phrases out of advertising culture, things like I'd rather fight than switch, or, you know, stop in the name of love is a piece of kind of dead language, inert language that suddenly becomes animated in the hands of these pop musicians. And that's what I'm fascinated by, and that's why I like this image of the appropriation of the complaints.
And it's also telling that in one of your earlier books, Gun With Occasional Music, newscasts are delivered musically, without words at all, as if to say, as you just said, that the words, the literal words themselves are irrelevant.
Yeah.
And the music can sort of get you through. So at the end of the day, is this book about ownership and, you know, who owns creative ideas and things like that?
Well, I guess that there's a little inquiry nested inside this book on that subject, because it's a subject that's fascinated me and was particularly occupying me over the years that I was working on this. But it's not in this book's nature to bear down on any topic with any gravity particularly at all. So it grazes it and it fools around with the notion. But I don't think, you know, I think you could, I hope, very happily read the book and just find it a sort of embracing comedy of failure, sex and failure, and never have to think about plagiarism at all.
All right, Jonathan Lethem actually has a lot to say about ownership and creating new art by appropriating old art, but he doesn't just talk the talk. When we continue in a moment, we'll discuss how he walks the walk, too. His new book is called You Don't Love Me Yet, and Jonathan Lethem will be at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock, March 21st. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Soundcheck. What they tell the kind of story that keeps a young man on his toes. Oh, yeah. But when temptation waves a finger, it takes a better man to tell him. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're talking to author and music nut Jonathan Lethem, whose new book, You Don't Love Me Yet, features lyrics or fragments of lyrics for songs from his fictional band. Those lyrics are now available free and without restriction as part of Jonathan Lethem's Promiscuous Materials Project. And you're hearing one of the results of that in the background. Jonathan, this is Dan Crane?
Dan Crane, who... yes, stepped up, saw the website and grabbed onto these lyrics, which are a song called "The Moth of the Bee of the Birds," and sent me this MP3. And of course, what's so fascinating about Dan Crane is that he's the famous air guitar guy, Jorn to Rock, who I think he's been getting some coverage lately. He's a professional air guitarist. I guess you wouldn't do a segment on air guitar on your show. It's sort of like ventriloquism on the radio.
Kind of a zen thing for our medium.
But he's also, turns out his dirty secret as an air guitarist is that he can actually play one. And
you mean a real guitar?
Yeah.
Okay. And there he is doing your song, or his song to your lyrics.
Right.
So why do this? Why write? I mean, you actually wrote lyrics not for the book, but just, I guess, because once you got going, they started coming.
Well, and some of these are older, too. They're lyrics I've written over the years. Sometimes with a musician friend in mind, and sometimes just to fool around. And you know, I don't make any huge claims for any of these lyrics, as you know, they're certainly not poetry or important songs as such. But I think they're kind of, some of them are kind of funny, and there are certainly opportunities anyway for songwriters to connect with them and bounce off them, and it's been very gratifying and amusing project to kind of be the benefactor of. So it's for my pleasure first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. So you like the idea of art as a kind of fungus almost, where it sort of grows off the decay of previous art.
Well, you know, the form I work in most of the time is innately kind of grand and solitary. You know, there's sort of always just one novelist, and it's quite lonely, you know, very, very little collaborative opportunities. But I'm very, as I've made obvious, I'm very turned on by a lot of collaborative or even kind of semi-accidental art, stuff that arises out of the culture that doesn't completely belong to anyone. And I like appropriation art a lot. I like collage. So this was a way to sort of, gently invite people to collaborate with these lyrics and make something of them. I'm kind of throwing a bottle into the ocean.
Mm. You've gotten a fair amount of press just in the last couple of days because you've offered the film rights to the new book with very unusual terms, where I guess you don't get paid until the film actually finds a distributor, which is not the usual thing. But what struck me was that you wanted the ancillary rights to the book to revert not to you but to public domain.
Yeah.
5 years after the movie's premiere.
Yeah, the free option's getting attention, but that's certainly the more interesting part of it, and the provocative part of it, is that I'm asking a filmmaker to make a kind of lover's leap into the public domain with me and just be satisfied, as I was satisfied just to write the novel, be satisfied to make just a film and not cling to all these kind of speculative possibilities, which seem quite silly in a way, but they're almost always, if not always, legally bound up with any film deal. The rights to, for instance, make a play or a TV series or a comic book or a sequel to the movie, all of these are usually bundled by very aggressive studio lawyers. And I'm sort of saying, hey, let's just kiss those things off. you make a film, and then we'll let anyone play with the stuff after that.
Now, some of your promiscuous materials project also involves stories that you're offering, not for free, but for the grand total of a buck.
Right.
And there are some restrictions there. You don't want anything over, what, 40, 45 minutes?
Yeah, just to kind of, in that case, it's almost something to do with the kind of economy of attention. I think if there were suddenly, 20 feature films being made, it would be a kind of distracting environment for me as a writer.
But also, I mean, there's the question of how do you balance between, the desire to put things out there where people can access them and, the artist's need and right to make a living.
Well, the key is it's not an all or nothing thing. And, it's very seductive because the people who are aggressive about intellectual property rights tend to want it to be a black and white issue. And if you're against or let's say if you're in favor of the public domain at all, you must be a kind of anarchist who wants to just dissolve copyright. Well, in fact, balance is the key word. Every artist kind of walks this line between the what you'd call the commodity operations and the gift operations, which is an observation completely stolen from a brilliant writer named Lewis Hyde. And I'm just trying to emphasize, in this case, the gift operations. It doesn't mean I want the commodity ones to go away.
All right. So your stories are up on this website, Promiscuous Materials. The lyrics are there. And it seems to be going great guns because there's a whole bunch of MP3s. Some established artists have already taken a crack.
It's been very, very gratifying and also completely silly because it has that charming, antic quality that art takes on when it's done purely for pleasure. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely heedless activity.
Well, let's hear a band called Haunt doing a setting of some of Jonathan Lethem's lyrics. The song is called Second Longest Night.
Emily at the Continental Divide saying, why don't you bring your friends inside? You tell her that you'd like to, of course, but your friends are down drinking at the White Horse. Paula says that girl's got a crush on you, and you say, I know, but there's nothing I can do. And the one that's on your mind is dancing with her friend, and she's telling the joke from Alphaville again. And you can't get anywhere staring at the one that you love.
That's Second Longest Night, lyrics by my guest, Jonathan Lethem, music by Haunt, and part of the Promiscuous Materials Project. The choice of the word promiscuous, a somewhat loaded one for this for this project.
I mean, it's an example of the slightly teasing aspect of the project. It's sort of daring people to find it objectionable. But it also, the word promiscuous has a nice quality of motility, as I put it in another interview on the internet. People tend to Google that word.
All right. Now, we're going to hear one of the neat things about this is you can get multiple songwriters with very different takes on the same song.
Yeah. To me, the most exciting thing is when you hear different people attacking the same lyrics. You end up with these two artifacts that are not covers of one another. They're utterly independent songs, but with the same lyrics.
So here's John Linnell from the band They Might Be Giants, right, and his version of the same set.
Continental Divide saying, why don't you bring your friends inside? You tell her that you'd like to, of course, but your friends are down drinking at the White Horse. Paula says, that girl's got a crush on you, and you say, I know, but there's nothing I can do. The one that's on your mind is dancing with her friend, and she's telling the joke from Alphaville again. You can't get anywhere staring at the one you love. You can't get anywhere staring at the one you love. No,
Once again, the song is called Second Longest Night, lyrics by Jonathan Lethem, this time the music by John Linnell, who is best known as part of the band They Might Be Giants. And Jonathan, you know, the idea of free art, you know, art that's available, appropriated art, art based on other things, an expansion of fair use doctrine, it all sounds great. If John Linnell or any of these other guys suddenly has like a top 10 hit with one of these songs, are you going to be...
I'd be beside myself with joy. I mean, there are things that you have to understand are not under your command in the world. And one of those, one of the principal things as an artist is determining who does and doesn't make money, including yourself.
So you have determined that you will not make money from the Lyrics Project.
These things are it's so beside the point. It's not why I did them.
Well, congratulations. Now you're a songwriter after all of that. So the book is called You Don't Love Me Yet, and it follows the fictional exploits of a band that comes to be known as Monster Eyes after their hit song, which, of course, it being a book, we never get to hear. But we can go out with a band called The Nighttime and their version of the song Monster Eyes. Jonathan Lethem will be at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square on Wednesday at 7 p.m. Jonathan, great to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
And still to come on Soundcheck today, we have a live performance by the band Autumn Defense, made up of two guys who have at least three bands between them. They'll play live in our studio next. It's time to open up the Soundcheck inbox and check out what you have to say about the program. We got a lot of response to our segment about Asian Americans in pop music. Sandhya wrote to say that she's an Indian American with an experience similar to that of our guest, Chinese-Canadian rocker Wendy Ip. Wendy had said that lack of family support is the main reason for the lack of Asian American pop stars out there. Sandhya wrote, "Music runs in my family. Pretty much everyone sings or plays an instrument. My parents told me, however, that they would not pay for my education or support me in any way if I studied music. And my relatives in India, who are professional musicians with albums out, are also computer programmers or engineers. It's a cultural ethos, in a sense." But another listener, Chris, who's also Asian American and works in the music industry, said there are no cultural barriers or racism behind the issue. He wrote, "Talent, ambition, and drive, along with timing and a huge amount of luck, make stars in the music industry." Satellite's gone up to the sky. Another segment that got the emails going was the one about the potential merger between satellite radio rivals XM and Sirius. Kevin said he liked the idea. He wrote, "The FCC should approve the merger. Neither XM nor Sirius does it right, and a good competitor will eventually come along." But Lonnie, who has XM because of the music, wrote that his worry is that satellite radio will sputter out because, quote, "the newly merged company still won't make the investors instant quarterly billionaires." Show me what you got, little mama. Well, nothing topped the responses that we got to our segment about which musicians made the best lovers. It was the result of a fairly scientific study in the UK. Sophia wrote, "My husband of 10 years is a bass player, and I'm convinced musicians are the best lovers. We both are originally from Vienna, Austria, where this is somewhat common knowledge, at least among musicians and their partners. So with that, who needs science?" If you missed one of these interviews or just want to hear them again, everything is archived on our website, the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. You can listen on your computer or as a podcast. And keep writing. We're always at soundcheck@WNYC.org.